We are about to wrap up our spring fun drive here at WKAR Radio. We're doing it all online here at the end. And we want to acknowledge and thank the more than 470 listeners who have contributed over $65,000 in just a matter of days. We are grateful. Thank you very much. It's still not too late to make a donation or contribution. WKAR.org. Click on the Give Now link. Donate by 7 p.m. on Thursday, and you'll automatically be entered for a chance to win a night at Firekeepers Casino and Hotel in Battle Creek, a value of $250. Thanks to Firekeepers Casino and Hotel, a proud supporter of quality public radio for Mid-Michigan. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've got Current State here for Wednesday. Author and critic Touré will visit Grand Rapids on Thursday to take part in a program called Identity and Bias, Impact on Individuals and Institutions. Now, Touré has written extensively on subjects ranging from music to politics to black life in America. He's also been a TV personality on shows like MSNBC's The Cycle. Earlier this week, Current State Scott Pohl spoke with Touré about his role as a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominating committee and his book about Prince, I Would Die for You. Today we have the second part of that interview. Scott Pohl questions Touré about the Black Lives Matter movement, the presidential campaign, and his 2011 book, Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness? What It Means to Be Black Now, beginning with what he means by the phrase post-blackness.
We're just talking about viewing, performing, or embodying blackness in any way that you wish. It does not mean post-racial or a sort of leaving of blackness, but leaving the idea that blackness is one specific thing, is performed one specific way, and suggesting you can be black in any way that you want. It seemed to me like some people seem to feel like, you know, blackness was this fragile identity that required, you know, constant relationship to the hood, you know, like the hood was the refrigerator and blackness was milk. And the further it got away from the refrigerator, the more it would spoil and be useless. But, you know, that's not the case at all, that this is portable and flexible and fluid, and you know, you can perform or embody blackness in many, 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 many ways.
In the 5 years since its publication, have any of your conclusions changed in the 5 years since it was published?
I wouldn't say that the conclusion has changed. I would write an entirely different book if I was to start on that journey again, in terms of, you know, let's do a book that sort of takes the temperature of where I think, you know, Black America is. If I was writing now, or, you know, anytime in the last two years, I would do something much darker, much more serious, you know, something dealing with, you know, the Black Lives Matter issues, the new Jim Crow issues, you know, the mass incarceration, war on drugs sort of stuff. I'm proud of that book, but I think that it is very spiritual and poetic, and that has its place, but we also need to deal with the serious, difficult stuff, and that's not what I chose to do in that book, but then, you know, the response I got and the way that history has gone after that makes me say, you know, what I would feel necessary to do now would be dealing with more of the harder stuff.
We're talking with writer and TV personality Touré. He'll be in Grand Rapids for an event on April 21st. I'd like to ask you about a few issues related to racial politics and the current racial climate in the country. One thing I wanted to ask you about is some of the protests that have occurred at public appearances by presidential campaigns, and not so much about the protests themselves, but how the candidates and their surrogates like Bill Clinton have handled those protests. Do you have some thoughts on people speaking up at campaign events like that and how the candidates choose to react to them?
I mean, I have no problem with Black Lives Matter being aggressive in how they get their message out, and I think that it's interesting that that is the special interest group or that has had a greater impact on this election than any other. And I find it really valuable that instead of pressing the right to do better when we know they're not going to, and they're consistently horrendous on these issues, that they have pushed the left from the left, and not even really from the left all the time, but just they have pushed the left to be better. And this is the first time in my lifetime that I can remember the black groups pushing the Democratic Party to really earn their vote. Because black people, going back to LBJ and to a certain extent back to FDR, are voting in massive numbers for the Democratic Party. But when do we demand that they do something to earn that? And Black Lives Matter is doing that. And I don't have a problem with them going directly to a candidate at a public rally and demanding that, we speak about this issue now. If a candidate is not prepared to answer an important question from a citizen, then they have a problem and they need to think about what their answer should be. And, we see in Bernie, for one, somebody who has developed over time in his answer, right? It's the first time he got interrupted, it was disastrous for him. And he has learned over time how to deal with them. And Hillary has, too. The Bill Clinton moment was really difficult, because I love him. He was the first president I voted for, the first Democratic president of my adult life, and, extremely charismatic. I was an Arsenio watcher when he came on the Arsenio Hall show. So it's kind of like, symbolic of how Bill Clinton was like, I will come into your world and, tip my cap to you to let you know, I care about you. I mean, everybody's focuses on Arsenio because it's such a good video, but he was also on MTV, on an MTV forum that fall, and somebody asked him if he wore boxers or briefs. And it was this great television moment. So there was this deep love for him beyond, your relationship with a normal politician. So then to see him sort of at verbal war with Black Lives Matter, this group that means a lot to me, that I think is really doing important work, was sort of like, wow, two people I really care about are like at odds and you can't sit on the fence. You got to pick one or the other. And, reading what Michelle Alexander wrote about Clinton's tenure and what happened out of the 94 crime bill and what was in it and where it came from politically and where it went, he did not stand up to the demagoguing that the right was doing, and he swallowed it and tried to be even further. And that was hugely detrimental to the Black community. And Hillary's going to have to do better.
Do you think that's part of why Hillary Clinton enjoys such wide support amongst Black voters, though, the relationship to the way they feel about her husband? And why do you think Bernie Sanders struggles to appeal to African Americans?
Yes, the first question. Hillary definitely has inherited Bill's support among African Americans, which the Democratic nominee tends to enjoy, and she has seemed like the incumbent the entire time. It's interesting because Bernie has Ta-Nehisi Coates behind him, Rosario Dawson behind him, Spike Lee behind him, but he's got some really, really interesting, extraordinary Black people behind him. And I think a lot of people make some of these decisions emotionally, and there's nothing sort of at a gut level that suggests, Bernie understands. But he's a politician from an extraordinarily white area, And out of that, clearly he is, he shaped his politics and his instincts in a way that did not have to encompass what Black Americans need. And Do I think that he would do the right thing if he became president? Absolutely. But, you know, he's a guy who's been on the wrong side of many gun votes, as far as I'm concerned, and isn't able to really speak about sort of black issues with the sort of ease and fluency that we would hope for.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you to comment on Donald Trump's campaign for president. And while we're talking about Republicans, what did you make of Dr. Ben Carson's campaign?
I mean, you know, I thought Dr. Ben's campaign was, I mean, if I said it was embarrassing, that would imply that I accept that there is some refracted, you know, opinion, like what you think of Ben Carson that refracts somehow onto me and other black people. And I don't know that. Not sure if that's really happening. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. You know, I mean, I found his entire campaign to be extremely problematic. I mean, he's politically very juvenile, the way that he speaks, the things he speaks about. I just couldn't take anything about that campaign seriously at all. I mean, you know, the Trump campaign it's the inevitable end, you know, of allowing talk radio to define the agenda, of allowing, you know, obstruction and an attack on government and a philosophy of being anti-government and wanting to make government so small you would strangle it in the bathtub, but then not actually killing government. So then eventually somebody would come along and say, they've been promising you anti-government and not doing it. I can out-Republican them. I can outright them by saying, I'm not from politics, so I'll do it better than them. Like, of course, that would eventually be the next answer. You know, this sort of politics of anger and fear that they've been playing on for 50-some years, that, of course, had to, you know, just keep going to the nth degree. And this seems like pretty much the nth degree. I mean, like, the Trump voter makes the Tea Party look like a bunch of wimps. You know, it's crazy. It's a bit scary to see the anger and the bile and the vitriol sort of coming out so publicly in this way, you know. And I think it's detrimental to America already. And another several months of him running his mouth on the national stage would be further detrimental to America, but you know, we have one party in the country that is barely functioning, that isn't really for anything, and is in government to try to make government not work. That doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Author and commentator Touré will be part of Forum 2016 in Grand Rapids at DeVos Place on April 21st. It's sponsored by Partners for a Racism-Free Community in Grand Rapids. Touré, thank you.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And coming up on Current State, the National Council on Alcoholism in the Lansing regional area is the longest-serving alcohol and drug treatment agency in Greater Lansing. They've been serving the community for over 50 years. For Neighbors in Action this week, we'll speak with the agency's Jessica Robinson and a participant in one of their recovery programs. That's on the way. Well, a closely watched forecast of Michigan tourism suggests the industry is in for its best year in almost a decade. This year's Michigan State University Tourism Outlook predicts 3% more tourists and 5% more tourism spending than in 2015, which also turned out to be a good year. For more, I spoke yesterday with the two key researchers in the MSU tourism forecast, Professors Sarah Nichols and Dan McColl. I first asked about some of the factors they consider.
Well, over the course of the year, both Dan and I collect a vast amount of data relating directly and indirectly to the performance of the tourism industry. So we look at gas prices, we track the weather, obviously a huge influence on travel. We look at a variety of economic factors, consumer confidence, pricing in general, hotel prices, food prices, a lot of different hotel indicators, so levels of occupancy as well as the prices of those rooms.
Currency valuations as well, correct?
Yes, currency. So for this year, the currency exchange was quite an issue, particularly the Canadian dollar relative to the U.S.
But the big takeaway numbers here, I guess, are a 3% increase in tourists in Michigan this year and a 5% increase in tourism revenue. Dan, can you put those numbers in some kind of perspective for us? Are those really significant jumps?
They are. We do the 5% in spending is rather significant. One of the things that we've seen is people are spending more and more on their travels, non-experiences lately. This has been a wider shift in society, you know, especially led by the millennials, that there seems to be more of a prioritization on paying for experiences versus stuff. As for the 3% volume, that just shows steady increase in the people coming and traveling around Michigan.
And are there some factors that are more relevant in increases this year, for example? Do some factors just play a much bigger role than others?
This year, the interesting thing is that the economic factors were all moving in the right direction. So in other words, consumer confidence, so people's confidence in the economy and their jobs, and I think their willingness to spend on discretionary items like travel was up. Gas prices were way down. Michigan gas prices fell 27% in 2015 compared to 2014. Mm. What was interesting was that the weather actually really wasn't that good last year, but it didn't actually seem to make a whole lot of difference. The summer was really average. The winters were both relatively poor. So the winter before last was really cold and dry. The most recent winter was really warm and wet, especially in December. We really only had one good weather month, and that was September, which was really quite warm and dry,
and that really,
which made for a really nice fall.
And that really is interesting, because usually the weather makes a big difference in the travel patterns, and it wasn't a prime. Usually when you have a great year for tourism like we had last year, the weather cooperated, and that was not the case.
Has weather ever spoiled an otherwise strong-looking year?
Well, normally, as I said, when you see the strong years, it's usually a good weather year. There have been times when the weather hasn't been great, and we've seen that in the indicators that we look at. So weather has been more explanatory than it was in the past year. You know, this year will be interesting. You know, and it's also industry dependent, right? So a lot of the tourism that happens in Michigan is in the summer months. So you really want July and August to be great. Fall is increasingly an important time, and actually last year fall was quite good. This winter, however, was off to a bad start for the ski area. They didn't The ski areas didn't have any snow, and it was too warm to make snow over Christmas, and that really is an important time for the ski industry.
Dr. Dan McColl and Dr. Sarah Nichols are researchers who assemble the annual Michigan Tourism Forecast here at Michigan State. Their new forecast, which is quite positive for 2016, has just been unveiled. There was one slide in your PowerPoint presentation, Sarah, which we'll provide a link to on our website, by the way, at WKAR.org. But the slide was titled, "People Quitting Their Jobs is a Good Thing." How is that? How does that work?
That was on my slide.
Oh, okay. Take it, Dan.
So I'll speak to that. So what we've seen, and this is throughout the United States, that there has been an increase since 2009 in the number of people who are voluntarily quitting their jobs, and a decrease in the number of people who are being laid off. This is pretty typical in any kind of recovery, but it is a good overall sign of strength in the economy, because if people are willing to make a job switch voluntarily, it shows that they have confidence that they can find another job or have already found another job.
Or more people are retiring and may have time to travel, I suppose.
Yeah, that's true, though these numbers don't specifically take into consideration people retiring. So.
Now, a lot has been made of Pure Michigan tourism commercials in recent years. Sarah, can you say they've had an impact?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think there's no doubt they've had a tremendous impact. Travel Michigan commissions a study every year to look at the return on investment on that campaign, so the amount of money that the state treasury receives compared to how much it paid to support the campaign. And the most recent return on investment figure, which was just announced today, is $7.67 back for every dollar invested. So that's all new spending by out-of-state visitors who have come to Michigan because they've seen one of those ads.
Mm. And I would add that it's had a lot to a big positive impact on changing the perception of the state of Michigan. So the Pure Michigan campaign started in 2006, but really went national in 2009, 2010. And at that time, bring yourself back, Michigan was at the very bottom on just about every economic indicator. We were the only state to have lost population from 2000 to 2010. And everything in the national news around Michigan seemed to be negative between, you know, Rust Belt connotations in Detroit, problems in Detroit, that sort of thing. And here comes the Pure Michigan campaign introducing to the rest of the country another image of Michigan. And I think it's an image of Michigan that a lot of Michiganders are aware of, and certainly people in the surrounding states. But for the rest of the nation who don't drive through Michigan on their way anywhere, I think it was a well-received and surprising message.
Sarah, I take it we're also coming off a pretty strong 2015. Are we on some kind of roll here?
Well, let's hope so. I mean, 2015, I think for a lot of the hotel properties, a lot of the attractions and cities and regions around the state was their best year ever. It was really fantastic to talk to all of the industry members that we sort of solicit information from and hear just so much good news. It was a fantastic feeling to be able to present that information to the industry and hope, you know, fingers crossed for another really strong year next year.
How often do good years repeat?
Well, we're actually in sort of our fifth really good year in a row. So like you said, let's hope we are on a roll. I think what's important at this point is to continue to see sustained, steady growth.
And Sarah, do people come to Michigan for our parks, our lake shores? Is there a pattern here to what they're coming to Michigan to see?
Well, I think the one of the great benefits of Michigan is that we have everything. We do have the natural kinds of experiences. We have the lake shores, as well as, of course, the urban experiences. But what we saw last year was really a boom in the visitation to our National Park Service sites. So the U.S. has just over 400 National Park Service sites, and across the nation they saw a 5% increase last year. Our sites had a 20% increase, so 10% at Sleeping Bear Dunes.
Now, why is that? Why the spike?
I think it's tied to the Pure Michigan campaign, and Travel Michigan is sort of more actively working with the National Park Service to promote those sites.
Very good. Dr. Sarah Nichols and Dr. Dan McColl are researchers who assemble the annual Michigan Tourism Forecast at Michigan State University. Their new forecast, which is quite positive for 2016, has just been unveiled. Sarah, Dan, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
And the long-awaited Whole Foods in East Lansing opened last week. Coming up on Current State, I go to a Whole Foods for the very first time to see what all the buzz is about. That and more after the break on Current State. Current State, three times every weekday on WKAR, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5 FM, and every day at noon on AM 870. I'm Mark Bayshore. Deciding to seek help for addiction is likely the biggest step toward recovery, but there are many steps after that one. The National Council on Alcoholism serving the Lansing area offers programs designed to assist people who want help. In our Neighbors in Action segment this week, we're going to take a look at their programs and find out more. Joining us here in the studio is Executive Director of the National Council on Alcoholism in the Lansing Regional Area, or NCALRA. It's Jessica Robinson. Hi, Jessica.
Good morning, Mark.
And also with us is Stacy Hiller, who's been a participant in a recovery program at the agency. Stacy, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Jessica, you've got two residential centers
and then you've got a transition home. Describe briefly for us here what happens in the residential centers, what happens in the transition home.
Okay. So during the time that a candidate comes into recovery, they will be evaluated based on a survey, essentially, which kind of gives them a healthcare model. With that, we work with counselors who provide a treatment program. So it's a specific program that they have in terms of laying out, identifying skills, identifying difficulties that the person may have behaviorally, mentally, emotionally, and also health-wise, physical health-wise. So with that, they provide a specific treatment program to each individual's needs.
Okay.
And in the recovery homes, they come into a home-like structure. So it is a household where they share rooms and also work with peers. They have one-on-one support, group support. They work on skill building, work in participation in all of the household chores, and also are activated in terms of continuing relationships with outside community members who are in recovery. So we give them access to the outside recovery community and introduce them to all the many different ways that they can stay connected as they leave the house and transition into regular daily living.
Okay. And what does your – describe a kind of a common recovery program. What are the main features of the kind of recovery program that you – you find yourself, or do they vary so much there isn't a most common recovery program?
Well, for our program, it includes treatment. So we will work with the person in terms of their medication, in terms of health care, so they will be able to access doctor's care, they access dental care, they access one-on-one counseling for mental health and behavioral health issues. They work together in groups for group support. They practice skill building, journaling. They work on what we call didactics, which are specific homework assignments is the best way I can describe it for somebody who's outside of the that realm, which will help them to identify and kind of connect with the things that really start to get in the way of them being able to live a normal, healthy life.
Stacy, you've been through a program at the Glass House. Is that a residential center, or is that okay? That,
it is indeed.
That's a residential center. How is it you came to be there?
Well, I had struggled with addiction and alcoholism for quite a while, and I kind of was to the desperation point that I needed some serious help. I tried to do it on my own quite a few times, and it just was not working for me. So. I actually had set up a meeting with the NCA for intensive outpatient treatment, and I went to my first class, and when I was finished with it, I knew I needed something more intense, so they recommended the Glass House.
So you became a resident.
Yes, for 77 days.
Now, can candidates come to you and say, "I'd really prefer an outpatient kind of approach here"?
Absolutely. Okay. When candidates come for help, we work with them specifically one-on-one to identify what they truly need in terms of the programs that we serve. So we have outpatient, we have intensive outpatient, which is just a more intensive programming, and we have residential, and then we also have transitional housing. Now, transitional is once they have accomplished some residential treatment, they will move into what I would consider like three-quarters or a halfway program where they're still experiencing some of the programming of the NCA but have a lot more independence. So they begin to seek jobs, education, they begin to be self-supporting, and just utilize a lot of the peer-based recovery supports.
Stacy, I want to ask you, how soon after your very first visit here did you realize that you really needed something more than an outpatient approach? Was that during that first meeting, or was it some number of days or weeks after that? Or, I mean, how long did it take you to realize, hey, I need more than the outpatient
approach? It was during the first meeting.
No kidding.
Yes, I kind of had a hard time concentrating, and I was just, you know, I was just kind of, I was emotionally spent. I was desperate, and thankfully, they got me in right away because typically there's a waiting list, but they were able to get me in right away. So I am so thankful.
77 days in the residence. What aspects of the program were most impactful for you? Where was NCALRA really able to help you? Can you pinpoint one or two?
Well, one of the nice things is working with the actual people that work in the program. A lot of them are in recovery themselves, so they can identify and relate to me. Or they could. So it was really nice to be able to work with people that understand, you know judgments, and they're very helpful, very insightful. Also, the didactics were a big part, and the treatment planning from the counselors were helpful because you were constantly, like Jessica said, doing your homework. Mm-hmm. And say I had a problem with shame and guilt. I had a lot of shame and a lot of guilt that I was trying to work through, and so that would be one of my homework assignments that I'd work on for, you know, a few weeks or so. Mm-hmm. And just a lot of literature, a lot of one-on-one, a lot of group. It was all beneficial. The structure of the program was very helpful because they don't give you time to just sit and think about everything. You are constantly busy doing something.
It's like a good kid's summer camp. I mean, they are busy from dawn till dark, right?
Yeah.
I understand the impact of that. And Jessica, you yourself have gone through the recovery program. What can you tell us about your past, your challenge?
I am in long-term recovery. That is true. I've been sober for 8 years, or actually a little over 8 years. The impact of the program of recovery, and I came in through what they would call the 12-step programs, is exponential. It's when I was still in the throes of what I would call addiction now. You know, at the time it was just depression, bipolar. I was diagnosed with a lot of different issues. Obsessive compulsive disorder. I had been through all kinds of things, you know, obesity.
How would you say your own experience impacts the work that you are doing now?
I think it gives me a great deal of passion
for
the person who walks in.
It has to inform what you do.
It absolutely does. I think that the personal experience of struggling with and suffering through that kind of mental and physical health, and I would call it an epidemic at this point, it's an epidemic that people are experiencing in the Lansing area today, just pushes me. It drives the passion that allows me to serve.
Do you help people with, do people with opioid issues end up getting involved with your agency?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. I mean, that has, you say epidemic, and I think more and more of us are inclined to think of opioids before they think of any other issue. What role do volunteers play in what you do?
We use volunteers a lot. We actually connect with the 12-step programs in the Lansing area. There are over 350 community support groups in the Lansing area, 12-step recovery being part of that community support. We rely heavily on volunteers from that program in order to mentor the men and women that are in our program.
Stacy, where are you at right now?
I'm in a really good place today.
Good.
I'm continuing my recovery every single day. It's one day at a time.
How much work is it now compared to the 77 days you spend in the residence?
Well, of course, it's a lot different because I'm on my own now.
Yeah.
But I still am active in the 12-step program. I go to meetings every day. Or at least I try to every single day. I'm also involved with the NCA as well, still in outpatient therapy. And I plan to stay in it as long as I need to. When you want something as bad as I do, then you're willing to go to any length to
get it.
To get it.
Yeah. We wish you both the best of luck, and we commend you on all your important work here. Is there a website here where people can learn more?
There is indeed.
Jessica?
You can learn more at ncalra.com. We also have a GoFundMe page at GoFundMe.com/NCALRA.
NCALRA.com. I've been speaking with Jessica Robinson, Executive Director of NCALRA, and Stacy Hiller, a participant in one of their recovery programs. Jessica, Stacy, thanks very much.
Thanks,
Thank
Martin.
You.
Well, after much anticipation and some delay, East Lansing finally got its Whole Foods last week. The opening triggered a retail frenzy, the likes of which we haven't seen in a while. Current state producer Katie Cook used to work for Whole Foods, and though I'm not proud to admit it, I had never set foot in one, so we decided to go check it out together. Well, for years and years now, I have heard nothing but extraordinary comments and reviews about Whole Foods, and I guess it's kind of confession time. I have never until today set foot in a Whole Foods store. So I'm here with current state producer Katie Cook. We're standing right outside the Meridian Township location. Should I finally step inside my first Whole Foods? I guess I should. Let's cross the threshold here. Okay, I'm in. No harps, no angels. What's the deal? Oh, well, we'll learn more.
All right, we're looking for Ryan. Go around to customer service. What's your first impression?
It's busy. It looks like there are lots and lots of areas to explore. Very colorful. Nicely laid out.
Hi, my name's Ryan Duncan, and I'm the Associate Store Team Leader for Whole Foods Market East Lansing.
All right, Ryan, shall we hit the store?
Let's do it.
All right. Okay, we're with Aiden, who's the manager of the produce team. What's most awesome in the produce department here, Aiden?
Right now, it's these organic whole trade peaches.
So it's peach season?
In Mexico.
Okay.
They are just of such a high quality, and they also carry the whole trade guarantee, which guarantees a workable wage for right. the workers there, and it also helps support the Whole Planet Foundation, which provides microloans to some of our producers.
Mark, did you want to try one of these peaches out, see if you like it?
Sure. Okay. Pretty firm. But pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well done. We're off to a good start. It's the finest peach I've had in at least 6 months.
Hi, Charlie.
So Charlie's the meat and seafood team leader here. Tell us about this initiative here you've launched.
It's a newer program regionally, but we smoke everything in-house, we cure everything in-house, and cut everything in-house.
Would you like to try some?
Heck yeah. Nothing better after a peach.
Why don't we just try the jerky?
Try teriyaki or original?
Original.
All right. So this is some of our grass-fed, original-flavored smoked jerky that we make here in-house. If you want to go ahead and grab a piece out of there.
All right. Mmm, that's jerky. Well, we just walked into the bakery here, and I'm seeing some pretty fabulous-looking bread and bagels and sweeter items and just about everything you would want to indulge yourself with along the lines of baked goods is, oh, look at the cakes and the pies and the mousse cups. Oh boy. Oh, look at the cookies. Wow, you take your cookies pretty seriously. Those are like some of the thickest cookies I've ever seen.
Yep, we offer over 40 different varieties of cookies here. Do you see anything interesting in this case that you want to try right now?
I am a cookie monster, just about anything. Ooh, the jumble nut cookie.
Let's try a jumble nut.
Indulgent. Wow. Very good. Well, who doesn't love really good cheese? Now, as it turns out, the producer of this piece, current state's Katie Cook, is a former Whole Foods cheesemonger.
one of the best cheeses, I think, in the world, one of the best styles of cheese is the triple cream brie. And Mark, I know you're a fan of brie as well. The triple cream, you know, when they make cheese, they separate the curds from the whey.
Right.
So a triple cream has cream added to it before that separation happens.
I'm so fond of it.
Yeah.
So you end up getting like really buttery, creamy cheese.
We're going to go for it here. Do you know what we're about to tear into here?
Yeah, this is Delice de Bourgogne. It is a true triple cream French brie.
Here we go. Stinky in a good way. Cheese enthusiasts will say stinky, and it's not necessarily a bad thing to say. Oh my gosh. Unbelievably sinful. That is just fabulous. Well, to the strains of the Who, we want to thank Ryan Duncan, who is the associate team leader here of the new Whole Foods. You've made my first Whole Foods experience really pleasant and informative, Ryan. We wish you well. Thanks.
Glad to hear it. Thanks so much, Mark, and we look forward to having you back.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR, we can probably all remember a moment where our life totally changed direction. Maybe it was something big like a marriage or a divorce, or something as small as a book or a song that changed the way you thought about the world. Chuck Upshaw told us about an experience that shaped his life at our pop-up stories at the Broad Art Museum in March. Here he is with the story of his lucky break.
My father was in pain. Terrible pain, horrible pain, scream out loud pain. He hurt so much, he didn't want to move. But he turned around in his seat and said to the people behind him, and that's not the beginning of the story, I'm getting ahead of myself. Sometimes your lucky break can be something that never happened. I had just tried out for the 9th grade play and was not selected for a part. I did not want my mother to know that. But on our way home, my friend Greg, who was in the back seat with me, blabbed. Chuck, I thought for sure you'd get that part. You were the best one. I flinched. My mother turned around and said, "What part, Chuck?" I held my breath. And then I told her. She didn't say a word. She was quiet. And I knew that was not good news. Because she could never imagine her son not getting some kind of part in a school play. And that this would necessitate a trip to school and a conference with the principal. And when my mother went to school and talked to the principal, it never turned out well for the principal. As luck would have it, there was a PTA meeting the next week at school. It was one of those PTA meetings where a teacher would sit at a table with a group of parents. When my mother found out about this, she and my father hatched a plan. And as luck would have it, they sat at the same table with the drama teacher, Mr. Cole. When my mother found that out, she sprang into action. My mother and father had the plan that my father would be good cop, my mother would be bad cop. My mother was always bad cop, except those times when she was worse cop. She asked Mr. Coles why, during the drama tryouts, her son had not received a part. He said that it was a family play, and you could not have a Negro father and a white mother. Oh, no, he didn't. Bless his heart, he didn't know that it would have been far better for him to say Chuck's audition was terrible, he sucked, and better luck next time. But once he injected race into the equation, my mother tipped over the worst cop. When my mother was worst cop, it looked and sounded quite a bit like Georgia when Sherman was marching through. There was another woman at the table, a white woman, who said that she had just moved her family from Fort Benning, Georgia, and there at the fort, there was always plays with mixed cast, black, white, brown, red, yellow. And my mother, who was never a fan of interracial romance, said, why would that be a problem? There are many mixed couples these days with mixed families. As other parents in the room heard what was going on, they drifted over to this table. That PTA meeting became legendary in the Denver Public Schools. They talked about it for years. Most people came and just listened to what was going on, but some people came and sided with Mr. Cole, some people came and sided with my parents. As the conversation went on, voices were raised, names were called. One version has my mother asking another mother, do you think we need to take it outside? People say that by the end of the meeting, Mr. Cole was weeping. I don't believe that, but for sure he felt like crying. This was the end of the year, and there was going to be graduation. And the custom in my school was to have ninth graders write speeches to be given, and have ninth graders give the speech. Right before graduation, Mr. Cole called my mother and asked if I would like to give one of the graduation speeches. He was still shaken from that PTA meeting, probably suffering from PTSD. But I got a chance to give the speech. I practiced and practiced and practiced and practiced and practiced some more and practiced again. And my mother had me practicing in the morning before school and in the evening after school and at night before I went to bed. I practiced the words, the voice, intonation. I also practiced the gestures. And it's an example of how much I practiced that. 55 years later, I remember the speech. Mountains to climb. A climber stands at the bottom of the mountain, looking up, waiting to climb. My mother and father were in the first row of the balcony, and a couple was sitting behind them. As I finished the speech, the woman said to her husband, I wonder who that colored boy was who gave that speech. Said he did a fantastic job. My father was in pain, terrible pain, horrible pain, scream out loud pain. But he turned around in his chair and said, that's our son. I didn't get the part in the play. And maybe if I had gotten the part in the play, I would not have been asked to give that speech. And I wouldn't have found that I liked public speaking and I was good at it. And I wouldn't have given the next speech and the next speech and the next speech and the next speech. And I might not even be here tonight telling you this story. But sometimes, sometimes, a lucky break is something that never happened.
We've got another Pop-Up Stories event coming up very soon. Join us at Scene Metro Space tomorrow evening for stories on the theme of Fools Rush In. We get started at 6 o'clock at Scene Metro Space in East Lansing. If you want to tell your own story, email us, please, at currentstate@wkar.org. You can also stay up to date on all of our upcoming events by liking our Facebook page at Pop-Up Stories Lansing. And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, Michigan House Minority Leader Tim Grimmel joins us. The Jackson Symphony Orchestra is welcoming a new music director. We'll get to know the new guy in the Michigan classical community, Dr. Matthew Aubin, and learn about his connection to the Golden Globe-winning TV series Mozart in the Jungle. That and more Thursday on Current State. Thanks again to the more than 470 WKAR supporters and listeners who have contributed over $65,000 to our spring fundraising drive here just in the last week or so. We are grateful to you for your calls and your clicks. And though we're winding it down, it's not too late to contribute. WKAR.org. Click on the Give Now link, please. It's not too late. as an added incentive. We've got a night stay at Firekeepers Casino and Hotel in Battle Creek, and everybody who contributes by 7 p.m. tomorrow evening will automatically be entered in the drawing for that. It's a $250 value. Thanks to Firekeepers for their support of WKAR. Again, that's WKAR.org. Click on the Give Now link. We thank you. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. April Van Buren directed the program today. Thanks as well to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill for engineering. The Current State podcast is your informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. From politics to education, environmental news to healthcare, science and technology to music and theater, stories from around Michigan and your hometown. That's the Current State podcast anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. We'll be looking for you Thursday on Current State.